This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. There's an old reporter saying that prediction is the lowest form of journalism. Now, I wouldn't swear by that, but there's certainly some truth in it, at least. Fiction, however, is an entirely different story. When it comes to predicting what the future is going to look like and be like and feel like, fiction might be the way to go. And nobody in our time can beat the novelist William Gibson at prediction. Gibson's new novel is called Agency. Here's Josh Rothman, an editor at The New Yorker.
When William Gibson came up with the term cyberspace in the late 70s, there was no real internet to speak of. He'd been walking around Vancouver, which is where he lived, and he'd noticed kids playing video games in video arcades. And he noticed that when you went to a video arcade and you watched the kids, they would duck and weave as though they were in the game. And that alone was enough to get into his mind the idea that, yeah, we want to be in there. We want to be in the computer world. And in fact, that's true. We do want to live in the computer world. So much of what we've done with this technology over the last 30 years, 35 years, has been about finding new ways to merge the digital space and the real space. Finding ways to take a selfie and get it into the digital world as quickly as possible. He would be the first person to say he got a lot of technical details wrong about cyberspace. He pictured it as a virtual world, like a VR, like Tron. And that's not what it turned out to be. It turned out to be the browser on your phone. But what he got right was that people really want to be in a virtual world all the time. They're always thinking about wanting to be in a virtual world. And the thing is that, you know, that seems really futuristic, but it was true in 1979 in Vancouver. You just had to see it. And that's Gibson's, you know, special superpower. Just to look at the world that we're in right now and to notice the parts of it that are futuristic. Gibson's idea is if you want to see the future, you don't have to picture some totally different world. You just have to take seriously what you know already is coming. Like the scientists say, climate change is coming. That's the future. And one of the things you have to do, therefore, is you have to constantly update your sense of what the present is. You have to really look at the present and take it on board. And that means that sometimes things happen in the present, and they really mess up your concept of what the future was going to be. And that's what happened to Gibson when he was writing his new book.
This book mutated out of the book that I was writing the night of our most recent presidential election.
I spoke to William Gibson a couple of weeks ago at a reading in Brooklyn.
I had a book that I was thinking of as sort of a romp, and I woke up in the morning and I realized I'd never be able to write that book. Because that book was set in 2017, and I thought the zeitgeist I was working with is gone. Most people haven't noticed it yet, but it's gone. And by 2017, it'll be, like, really gone. After, you know, a couple, actually about 3 months of deep unhappiness, I realized one day that I was feeling a complete sense of unreality. Like I did not believe at that moment in the news feed. And I thought, this is bullshit. This can't be happening. I'm dreaming. And then I thought, no, I'm having a surgical procedure. And they've got me way down under, but I'm starting to come up. And that's why I'm starting to question this ludicrous drugged reality that, and I thought, no, this shit's real. And I looked over at the laptop that contained my dead novel, and I thought, what if Verity and Eunice are living in a stub in which that election went the other way?
So in Gibson's new book, it's called Agency, there are two time periods. There's a future and there's a present, and they've contacted each other. And the idea in the book is, whenever the future contacts the past, it makes a new timeline. It kind of makes a divergence, like a fork in the road. And this new timeline is called a stub. The people in the future have an interest in what's happening in these stubs. And that's because what lies between the stubs and them, or between us and the future, is something that Gibson calls the jackpot. And the jackpot is Gibson's term for basically, you know, the end of civilization and the natural world as we know it.
Are people happier there? She asked. Happier than they were here, then? I gather they aren't, particularly. Pity, she said. Ready for tilapia tacos? Place on Tottenham Court Road. Better Mexican in your new stub, no doubt. Why aren't they happy there? The drivers for the jackpot are still in place, but with less talk at that particular point. He took a seat at the table. They're still a bit in advance of the pandemics, at least. She took the seat opposite. Nothing before the 2020s has ever seemed entirely real to me. Hard to imagine they weren't constantly happy, given all they still had. Tigers, for instance.
So if you think about, like, a Michael Bay disaster movie, you know, it's one thing that does us in, like an asteroid or a plague or, you know, aliens, something like that, one thing. But that's not how Gibson thinks about this. The idea of the jackpot is, if some of the stuff you read about in the paper that's happening right now already, if all those scary things just keep happening, you get the jackpot. The reason it's called the jackpot is it's because, you know, it's like in the slot machine. If everything comes up cherries, if it turns out that the oceans do rise quite a lot, coronavirus actually is really bad, and there's actually many other coronaviruses. A lot of wildfires do happen and continue to happen. The hurricanes really are pretty bad. 80% of people die, and the result is a world that's clawing its way back, that's trying to survive and rebuild. It looks like this.
To the horizon stretched a regularly spaced array of towers, roughly similar in height, through which, she saw, lowering her gaze, wound a river's serpentine curves. There, said Rainey, pointing out something Verity couldn't distinguish. London Eye, only tall thing aside from the original shard that you'll have seen before. They took down what was left of the rest. These are called shards, too, after the first one. Relatively few are habitations. What are they? Windows were lit, a few, if the lights she saw were windows. They scrub the air, the woman said, behind them, now standing. An older, lower city at the feet of the towers, like Lycan in comparison. There were forests, too, she saw, with greenways between them. That's the Thames? Of course, said Rainey. But with more bridges, at least two of them planted with what looked like forests of their own, and tributaries, none of which Verity remembered. Some of them appeared to have been roofed with glass, illuminated. CG, Verity said. VR, AR, a game. That's the commonest initial assumption, the woman said, on first seeing it, though I suppose natives of eras earlier than yours might assume dream, hallucination, visit to a supernatural realm. You're saying it's the future? Entertain the idea, to one side, so to speak. a mere possibility.
Gibson isn't saying that this is inevitable, that there's no possible future but this future. He's just saying, if you look at what's happening right now, this certainly seems to be eminently reasonable. You're in a unique position of being someone who for a really long time has thought about and imagined the future. And how has that changed? How has our idea of the future changed over that span?
Well, something that I find quite significant is that, you know, my childhood self watching the wooden TV would hear or see the phrase the 21st century virtually every day, often several times every day, often with one or more exclamation points following it. It's like, it's coming, the 21st century. This is back like in 1953 or something. And how often do you hear the phrase the 22nd century? Don't hear it. Currently, we don't have a future in that sense. We no longer have that sort of cultural anticipation that we took for granted through most of the 20th century.
I mean, I sometimes feel that the future is sort of claustrophobically foretold. So, like, I think of like the Elon Musk future, yeah, which is, you know, all-powerful artificial intelligence takes over everything, and climate change happens, and all the terrible things that will come from that happen. And in that sense, it feels like the future, it's almost hard to think about because it feels closed off. I wonder, is that how you feel about the future?
Well, something I've watched, having been a science fiction fan since I was 12 or 13, I began to realize that when science fiction writers got old, they started to complain about the world ending and everything going to hell in a handbasket. And it seemed to me that probably when everyone gets old, the world does end because the world they grew up in starts to go away. But then there's this thing of sort of transferring all of that onto a younger generation. So yeah, the world is ending, but young folks today, you know, what can you expect? That's ancient. Well, it turns out that's ancient. You know, you can find that on pot sherds from Babylon. It's always been going on. You can find it in ancient Greece. So I put it at the top of my list of kind of don't do things. Like when you get old, don't be that guy. Don't be that guy, because it's bullshit. Like, things are going to go forward. And I think I was right, but now I find myself old and looking at a situation that really does not look good. And it has, like all of those grumpy old sci-fi uncles of mine, I heard moaning in the 70s and 80s about, you know, how the world was going to hell in a handbasket. They still believed in a future. And now I'd like to believe in a future. And again, I kind of go, well, human nature, and kind of look at some of the worst examples of that around these days, and it doesn't really look good. And so I'm torn between believing that I'm just doing what the uncles have always done, and that I'm recognizing something that we haven't ever as a species actually seen before.
The novelist William Gibson, he spoke with The New Yorker's Joshua Rothman at a live event at Murmur Theater in Brooklyn. Gibson's new book, Agency, is out now. Friends, they come and go. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour, and in a minute, our music editor talks with the artist known as Thundercat. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
You're listening to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. That's music by Thundercat from his album coming out next month called It Is What It Is. Thundercat has cut an unusual path for himself. He was born Stephen Lee Bruner and started out playing bass with his father, who had played drums with Diana Ross and the Temptations. Bruner was in a boy band and then, strangely enough, moved on to a punk band called Suicidal Tendencies. As a session bassist, he worked with Erykah Badu, Childish Gambino, and the late rapper Mac Miller, who was also a close friend of his. Thundercat's particular way of merging jazz, R&B, funk, and hip-hop caught the attention of Kendrick Lamar, and they collaborated on Lamar's record To Pimp a Butterfly. Brianna Younger writes and edits music coverage for The New Yorker, and she talked with Thundercat last year while he was on a week-long residency at the Blue Note Jazz Club in New York.
I guess we'll start with where we are now, like with you in the midst of this residency. Like, how has that been going so far? Like, this is your first residency of this caliber?
Yeah.
Oh, ever?
Yeah, like I've never had a residency before.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
So people know you from To Pimp a Butterfly. A lot of people, at least, were introduced to you that way. But you also, you know, have a long resume from Suicidal Tendencies to playing with Erykah Badu. But let's go to the very, very beginning. And what even made you pick up a bass to begin with?
Well, I think I just had a natural affinity for, like, swords and, you know, sticks. You know, it's like there's that one kid that, you know, like you always got to tell him to put stuff down, or you're just playing a little too rough with things. There's a bit of that, but then there's also mostly my dad that inspired me, because it's like growing up in a house of musicians, you know, it's not saying that, I mean, it's indirectly saying you're going to play an instrument. Like, it doesn't matter, you know. It's intense, you know, and it's like, it's not always for the faint of heart. you have a family that does music, because everybody has an opinion, you know, everybody feels things differently, and you have to respect that. But, you know, it's like, it's just, you learn and you grow. You still grow and learn together, but it's like, it's just different. Me and my older brother would grow up playing together more than me and my younger brother. And in growing up with my older brother being, you know, that he's this virtuoso drummer, it was very intimidating, but it caused me to grow. You know, if I didn't have my brother around, I wouldn't play the way I play.
Some of your early records, like Young Jazz Giants, sound more in the vein of traditional jazz than, you know, as your work as Thundercat. How did you develop that sound and what would become the Thundercat voice over time?
The real thing is that I started writing music for my instrument. And a lot of the time when you have an instrument that you play, it can become a bit of a role, you know, where, like I was saying, you start to fall into the idea of, like, I'm working, so it's cool. But I would push out a bit, you know, and because I didn't play piano, you know, because I wasn't like this guy trying to be this R&B singer, I would always create from my bass. And once I realized that that was an option, it kind of took on its own life.
You've talked in the past about kind of your decision to play 6 strings versus 4 strings and how, like, in your collaborations with other artists, that was kind of a thing where people may have wanted you to play more contained or essentially to shrink yourself. So why the 6-string? Like, what are some of the nuances of that, and how has it allowed you to become the artist that you saw yourself as?
It's like, you know, like I would say, like, sometimes when people see the 6-string, it's immediately intimidating, or it denotes to you're about to play too much. It's just like, but a lot of the time, I would be writing, and that would be the best tool to write with for me because it gave me the most facility. And I wouldn't always take it out with me, but I would always be playing a 6-string on records that I would record for myself. It didn't become a reality until I had my other basses stolen, where I had to take that bass out, and that's where it started.
So your sense of humor is such a big part of what people know of you. Like, it's in your records, it's in your interviews. Like, anytime people hear Thundercat, it's a very lighthearted kind of situation. But, you know, life gets real, and that's also in the records. And
yeah.
I feel like Drunk was, like, the perfect culmination of I'm this funny guy, but also it's not always great.
Yeah.
Nobody move, there's blood on the floor. And I can't find my heart. Where did it go? Did I leave it in the cold? So please give it back, cause it's not yours to take. It must have felt when I lost.
You know, music sometimes can be like therapy. It can be, you know, soft and gentle, or it could be really, you know, intense and abrasive. And I don't know. I feel like humor is for the soul. You know what I mean? Like, it helps you get through. Even if it hurts, it's still better to laugh, I think.
One of the hardest things that I would imagine about being an artist is those tough times and the idea that you're expected to kind of process things in this very public way.
Yeah.
Obviously you've dealt with a lot of loss in your lifetime, but is that something you're feeling now with the recent loss of Mac and this idea that you'll be expected to somehow process this on your next record?
Well, I think it's the inevitable, first of all. It's like real life in art, you know, the imitation thing is real. I don't think it's expected. I mean, if I put out a trap album next, I would imagine that's just as expected.
Fair enough.
But it's moments like that, it's just what it is. It is what it is. I can't make up for something as precious as a life lost like Max. You know, it's no way it's not going to touch different places in my life, you know. There was a movie that came out some years ago with Denzel Washington and John Goodman, and it was about this like demon that would follow him through the city.
Oh, Fallen?
Fallen. You remember it? There were moments like after he died that felt a bit like Fallen or like They Live, because it was like everybody was in my personal life in that one moment, and I couldn't walk down the street without somebody looking and saying, I'm sorry, or like look, trying to catch my eyes. And it was a bit intense for me at first, but the truth is everybody mourns, you know, and Mac didn't just touch my life. That was just what that was proof of. And I had to see through that, you know, and like realize it is bigger. Again, it's bigger than me, you know. So my processing of it is, like I said, it's going to get touched.
Now I'm sitting here with the black hole in my chest.
Back to Pimp a Butterfly. Was that different than anything you've done prior?
Oh, yeah. That was a very demanding moment, you know. To this day, I still think, I look back on it and I think about how much output was going on in that moment. And along with that, you know, realizing that is the genius of Kendrick Lamar's writing, and like, it's rare, you know. It's like a lot of the time, especially in the rap game, rappers get far off into thinking it's just them. Kendrick was not afraid of anything. Like, and that would inspire me all the time. He would run up on all of it. We would have conversations about Joe Henderson. We have, you know, talk about those Miles albums. We talk about all kinds of stuff like that. It was just this continuous dance of like, it was almost like a trust fall. It was like I didn't know where I was going. And it was one of those things where when that album was finished, being there for the very last mastering session up until 7-8 o'clock in the morning, and I went home, I just almost fainted and cried, because it was just so, I was like, I had gone as far as I felt I could. I had given as all I could. You know, if I had lost like 100 pounds, that would have made sense. You know, but it was just like, I put my all. That's what I have from that, you know. It's like, and then we look up and then it's, you know, it's like, oh, 11 Grammys. We were like, Jesus, you know. It's like,
I was going to say, did you know? Did you know it would be this?
No. I didn't even have a suit on at the Grammys.
It really changed jazz and improvisational music. Yeah.
It wasn't just the awards. It became a political statement. You see what it sparked. As much as everybody, there's moments in history when we look back, there's Dave Chappelle, there's Barack Obama, and then there's that time when Kendrick put out To Pimp a Butterfly. And it pushed, it made people uncomfortable. It made everything a bit disheveled. It brought the cream to the top. It shook everything up. And I think this album is, this is definitely one of those albums that when we look back, it will stand the test of time of how,
oh, of course,
you know, it's just, thank Kendrick for being the vessel, you know what I mean? Like letting it happen. Cause he could have easily been like, you know, I'm gonna just put out this trap album.
I think you have a trap album on the way.
I keep saying this.
I think you're hitting.
You think I'm joking.
Love it. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Comb your beard, brush your teeth, still feel weird.
musician known as Thundercat. He spoke with The New Yorker's Brianna Younger last year. Thundercat goes on tour this month for his new album, It Is What It Is. That's The New Yorker Radio Hour for this week. I'm David Remnick, and thanks for joining us. Please join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Morgan Flannery, Meng-Fei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.